Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Cosi.org.
Hello citizen. Be advised this content creator is human and is therefore subject to human error. Any information provided by this content creator should be cautiously approached as it may be nothing more than allegation. Remember, trust your government, consume appropriate content, and be cautious of all conspiracy theories as they are the tools of the rebellion.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the 21CD podcast. As always, I'm your ghost, John. If this is your first time here, welcome. If you guys want to support the podcast, and I definitely hope you do because I need all of the support that I can get, you can head on over to 21CDstudios.com and you'll buy some merch or click on some of the other links you find there and follow me everywhere you can. Right now we have some propaganda flyers in the store and they're honestly pretty cool, I think. So check them out and give us a follow. That's the main way you can help in these early days of this young podcast. If you guys do want to support me financially, you can check out the Buy Me a Coffee link in the description. That's what helps fund my projects and my caffeine addiction. So our next project is going to be in Iceland, where we're going to be filming a documentary searching for the hidden folk. And we're really excited to be doing that in September. So if you guys want to be a part of that journey or support in any way, you can head on over to my Buy Me a Coffee. And I am aware that some people are having issues donating there, and I'm not sure why. I'm working on it. I'm going to try to find somewhere else because a surprising amount of you actually do want to throw me a couple bucks now and then, and that's amazing. You guys are awesome, so thank you so much. Okay, let's get into this stuff. So last week we talked about the evidence that archaeologists like Reverend Emmanuel Magri have found of some ancient lost species of reptilian, some kind of reptilian race in the catacombs of Malta. Remnants of the Brotherhood of the Snake, the Eternal Serpent Cult, the reptilian race from under the earth that pulls strings on the surface through mysterious and evil means. That's what we're talking about here. And if you guys haven't heard the first part of this, go ahead and check it out. It's the other episode that looks like it's the first in a series of things about this. So anyway, during this second part of the story, we are going to examine the potential explanations for what this ancient reptilian race really was or is, and we're going to kind of discuss their secrets, what they've hidden, where they are hidden, how they manage to last this long, where they might hide, and what their purpose or mission might be. We're also going to look at the most important of questions, which is, are they still out there today watching us, kidnapping our children and waging spiritual war on the world of all that is righteous? So I'm going to start with where we left off in the last episode, and strap in, folks, because we've got a lot of info to get out, and we're just going to be buzzing right through it. So here we go. As a Jesuit priest, Magri was part of the Catholic Church, an institution historically involved in controlling and preserving religious and historical narratives. If Magri's findings at the Hypogeum had implications that conflicted with church teachings or could undermine religious authority, there could have been a motive to silence him. And the idea is that revealing such findings might challenge the church's version of history, particularly in relation to creation, human origins, and the role of divine intervention. Magri's discoveries might have posed a significant threat to the established academic community. If he uncovered evidence that contradicted prevailing theories about human evolution, ancient civilizations, or the development of religious practices, it could have led to widespread academic upheaval. There might have been efforts to discredit or eliminate him, to protect the reputations and careers of prominent scholars and institutions invested in the existing historical narrative. After Magri's death, the Hypogeum was further explored by other archaeologists, but many believe that the subsequent work was either intentionally limited or that important discoveries were kept from the public eye. And again, for those who haven't heard part one, we're talking about these strange catacombs, these tunnels, and these mysterious rooms and treasures and findings and skeletons of some ancient race that is in the catacombs of Malta, beneath Malta, and extending to the Middle Eastern regions all around it, which is coincidentally the same area in the Middle East where we are experiencing current, very prominent troubles. And in my opinion, it's possible that the Brotherhood of the Snake, the ancient serpent cult, is a huge moving factor in this conflict and has been in this area since maybe the dawn of time. So when we talk about Dr. Magri, we're talking about his discoveries that go counter to this narrative and really perhaps blow a hole in what actually happened in our timeline. What Reverend Emmanuel Magri allegedly discovered could have had severe implications on the narratives being shaped at the time by both the church and what some theorists refer to as mystery Babylon cults. Including the Brotherhood of the Snake and the cults that worshipped these ancient snake deities in the area of Malta and the Black Desert, which is in Jordan, Jordan is partially covered by this Black Desert. If Magri's discoveries at the Halsafleni Hypogeum, which is the catacombs that are under Malta, included evidence of advanced ancient civilizations, non-human entities, or practices that predated or contradicted biblical accounts, it could have undermined key aspects of Christian doctrine. For example, the existence of a highly advanced prehistoric culture or otherworldly beings might challenge the church's teachings on creation, the uniqueness of humanity, and the timeline of human history. The church has historically played a crucial role in shaping and maintaining the narrative of human history, particularly in Europe. Discoveries that significantly deviated from this narrative could have threatened the church's authority, potentially leading to a crisis of faith among believers. Magri, as a Jesuit priest, would have been in particularly sensitive positions, balancing his duties to both his religious order and his archaeological pursuits. Imagine discovering things buried in the earth that seem counter to what the church tells you is the only truth, while at the same time being both priest and archaeologist. The term Mystery Babylon is often used by conspiracy theorists to refer to secret or occult groups that allegedly possess hidden knowledge passed down through ancient civilizations. And you guys have heard me talk about these ancient Mystery Babylon cults that started long ago and continue to this day and include like the Freemasons, the Brotherhood of the Snake, the Knights, whether they're Templar or Hospitaller or whatever they are. And we're going to talk about them soon. But these groups are all part of this Mystery Babylon and this cult system that we're talking about here. These groups are thought to possess the knowledge that's been passed down from ancient civilization to ancient civilization, and they're thought to be able to manipulate religious and political systems for their own purposes. If Magri's findings revealed ancient rituals, symbols, or knowledge that connected to these esoteric traditions, it obviously would have exposed or threatened the influence that these groups purportedly hold over society. So, the theory suggests that certain powerful groups, sometimes referred to as the Mystery Babylon cult, seek to control or suppress knowledge of humanity's true origins and history. And the way that I view it, it's a spiritual battle between the forces of, you know, good and evil. Magri's discoveries, if they indeed pointed to something like an ancient secret or some lost knowledge, would have been extremely dangerous to these Mystery Babylon cults, and this could explain why his findings might have been suppressed. But why is the serpent worship, which is what we see in this area, a worldwide phenomenon? Across many cultures the whole world over, we find evidence of ancient snake people or reptilian godlike beings. Just because we find a, you know, treasure trove of it at Malta does not mean it doesn't exist everywhere else. As a matter of fact, it seems to be a part of some kind of global religion, which is very interesting. According to the conspiracy theory of these ancient reptile gods, they are ancient deities that have been worshipped by secret cults and groups and, you know, whatever, parts of people for thousands of years. And these gods are often depicted as serpent-like beings with characteristics that blend human and reptilian features. The most prominent of these deities in the Maltese context, you know, from Malta, are believed to be connected to the underworld, which is why these catacombs beneath Malta are so strange. The reptilian gods are thought to predate even the earliest known human civilizations, with their worship possibly originating in a time before recorded history. And some theories suggest that these deities are connected to the Nephilim or other ancient beings mentioned in various religious texts, who were believed to have extraordinary powers and knowledge. And you guys know, if you're the OGs, or maybe even if you've been on this podcast for a little while now, you know how into this whole Nephilim idea I am. In Malta, the connection to these gods is often linked to the ancient megalithic temples and underground complexes like the Hall Cyphlini Hypogeum, the catacombs beneath Malta. And these sites are seen as places where the veil between the human world and the underworld is thin. It could be considered a dimensional bleed where, you know, dimensions are stacked on top of each other instead of side by side. They also might just exist all around as well. We're not exactly sure, of course, but it's possible that you could fall downward into a different dimension. These sites are seen as places where that veil, that dimensional opening, is very accessible. And it allows worshipers, especially worshipers in ancient evil ways, it allows them to connect with their ancient deities. The serpent cult, especially the one that is considered to be beneath Malta, is said to be a secretive group that has maintained the worship of these reptile gods through rituals and ceremonies that have been passed down through generations. The cult is believed to operate in the shadows, of course. It exists, but it doesn't, if you know what I mean, with its practices hidden from mainstream society to protect the knowledge and influence that the cult possesses. Because this is a global cult. This isn't just a little group of men and women who play dress up in the catacombs. This is stronger than a government. This is more money than a million Elon Musks. This is power and influence like your typical person would not be even able to comprehend. This is insane cult. This isn't Jonestown or something like that. Rituals associated with this cult will often involve the use of serpent imagery. You know, and I know that if you're Christian, you're probably thinking of the serpent that came to Eve in the Garden of Eden. But regardless, it will often involve the use of serpent imagery, possibly including statues, carvings, and symbolic rituals meant to invoke the power of these serpent gods. The cult might also use sacred sites, like the Hypogeum, for ceremonies, believing that these places can be charged with the energy, both of the earth and of the ancient deities that they're worshipping. And the reptile gods are often associated with the underworld, which is a place of death, rebirth, and hidden knowledge. The serpent cult in Malta might view these gods as gatekeepers to this realm, which is extremely possible when you think about it, because these gods, as we call them, are most likely fallen angels or demons, masquerading as gods, having created themselves as gods of the people they can influence, the beings they can manipulate, right? And through these gatekeepers, these gods, these cults of humans who are misled are offered the ability, the power to transcend, essentially, the mortal plane, or to gain secret knowledge that is inaccessible to ordinary humans. The Hypogeum and the underground temples, they're often seen as portals to this underworld, where the serpent cult performs rituals to connect with these reptile gods. Some conspiracy theories suggest that these rituals involve communication with the deities, or even attempts to bring them into our physical world, which, of course, if you read the Book of Revelation, seems to be what's going to end up happening, and what has probably already been happening for thousands of years. The serpent cult in Malta is sometimes linked to other ancient serpent-worshipping cultures around the world, like we already said. And, for example, we've got like the worship of Quetzalcoatl in Mesoamerica, the Nagas in Hindu and Buddhist traditions. We talked about these in the first part of this little series we're doing here. But there's also the serpent symbolism in Egypt, and all of this is seen to be a part of some kind of global network of serpent worship that has existed for a very long time. So what we're seeing is evidence that there was some kind of serpent imagery being used by some type of ancient being, assumedly, allegedly, that was all over the planet, manipulating man, making itself known, all over the planet. So according to the conspiracy, that serpent cult is not just a relic of the past, but it continues to exist in modern times, influencing global events from behind the scenes. I mean, it was something to ancient cultures. What was it? If it was so powerful to be the whole world over, why would it just disappear suddenly with the invent of steel buildings or whatever was the nail in the coffin to make the powers that be want us to believe in nothing instead of everything, right? Because at some point in history, that's basically what ended up happening. We went from believing that everything was a god, basically, to believing that there is no god. And somewhere in the mix, the serpent cult just sort of changed forms, it seems. What happened there? You know? Well, the cult has just changed. It's still around. It's just changed a little bit. The cults that worship these serpent gods are thought to be remnants of ancient alliances between these gods and early humans. And the serpent cult is not just gone. It's hidden. It's changed. The cult's members are believed to be part of elite circles, using their powers of knowledge, granted by these ancient reptilian beings to control society and to become powerful. The existence of this cult and its practices is said to be suppressed by powerful organizations that want to keep the knowledge hidden from the public, either to protect the status quo or to prevent mass panic. And we see examples of this in organizations like BlackRock, the Smithsonian, UNESCO. Like, there's just a massive push to suppress knowledge, especially of the ancient world and the way they did things. And some theories suggest that the serpent cult has survived through the ages, maintaining its practices in secret, and that they are still responsible for crimes in modern times, including war and religious crimes, and especially more intimate ones, such as the story of Mike Mannschult. He was a healthy 17-year-old German boy with a passion for adventure, and he would go to Malta on holiday and never show up for his flight back home. He ended up being found near the Dingley Cliffs, which are some cliffs in Malta, some pretty high ones, dead of an apparent fall. His bike and sunglasses and shoes would all be found some meters away from his body, but his bike didn't have any damage like you would expect from a fall from that high, and he didn't have a single broken bone in his body. So he falls from a cliff in Malta, but doesn't have any broken bones, despite being dead. His death is concluded as natural causes, and medical examiners would rule that he was dead for around 7 to 8 days when his body was found. Then, his body would be returned home to his family in Germany, with most of the organs missing. Mike's heart, brain, neck organs, lungs, liver, his pancreas, adrenal glands, the right kidney, the bladder, the stomach, and small intestine, they were all missing, and the only organs that were left in his body were his left kidney, diaphragm, spleen, and large intestine. Mike's body weighed just 16 kilograms when it arrived in Germany. Then it was found that there was no formalin in the body when it arrived in Germany, and formalin is used in the embalming process. But Mike's body was certified as being embalmed before it left Malta, but who knows? His death is concluded as natural causes. That doesn't make any sense. Why would everything be taken out of his body if he was dead of natural causes and then nothing returned to it? He's not embalmed. My first thought was, his organs were probably donated. The Maltese government or whatever, whoever it is that controls that sort of thing, took his organs and thought that maybe they could use them. But the problem is, if he was actually dead for so long, would his organs have even been usable? And if they were, why would you take a brain? We're not exactly doing brain transplants. So a Maltese court medical expert said that his brain was probably eaten by rats. But that's disputed because the only bite marks was on his neck, and there is nothing to suggest that rodents were ever in his body. Another theory is that Mike fell, but he survived, and he was just too weak to climb back up and died of hunger or heat exhaustion because it was July. But if he did fall, why wasn't he wearing his shoes? I can understand his bag falling into the sea or whatever, his bike, whatever, getting caught on some branches or something on the way down, but I've never heard of somebody falling from any height and their shoes sort of coming undone. And if he fell, why was there no damage to his bicycle? If it did hit the ground, why was there no damage done to it? Did he even fall down there in the first place? Or is it possible that, since he had no broken bones, he was killed somewhere else, his organs taken, and then he was dumped there to make it look like a fall? Having no broken bones and no damage to the bike is bizarre. He didn't even have any cuts. He didn't have abrasions or anything abnormal. anything that would signify that you fell from a cliff. So another possibility, though, is that he was robbed and he was pushed off the cliff. But if you're going to rob somebody of their bag and shoes, why wouldn't you take his bicycle? Mike's dad ended up coming to Malta during the search for Mike, and a few times he spoke with potential witnesses, and he followed up on a lead from a source, and he believes that Mike was not alone when he died. When Mike's body was found, doctors who were at the scene told him that his son's back was broken in two places. It was at the morgue when his father visited that a worker took him aside and told him that his son actually didn't have a single fracture in his body. So why was the government lying to him? And when the police have Mike's father with them, they give him his belongings and they have a camera, but Mike didn't actually own a camera that his dad knew about. So was this part of a cover-up or was it just a mistake? And were Mike's belongings actually found and stolen by police officers? Because there's certain things that were missing from what he would normally carry with him in his backpack. There's just a lot of questions that are kind of left unanswered. Byrne said that he spoke with a farmer who owned the area adjacent to where his son's body was found, and he asked him about Mike's backpack, and he said that the farmer seemed to be hesitant, and he got the feeling that the farmer knew more than he was telling. So, is that genuine, or is the father traumatized and trying to just find answers where there are none? His father said that the more he dug into it, the more he found that they were getting frustrated, and it seemed like they were challenging the reputation of the Maltese people and of the Maltese police force, saying they steal and they are corrupt, that they're covering something up. And this made the investigation very difficult. So why did the Maltese health authorities refuse to provide a copy of the autopsy report to Mike's family? Then, if there's nothing going on, why did the Maltese courts and police commissioner refuse multiple times to reopen the investigation, even after the German autopsy, which came back saying that there was definitely something suspicious going on, by the way? There's just a lot of questions, and in my opinion, this very well could have been just a strange murder, or it could have been something much more sinister relating to this, you know, serpent cult, this mysterious underground of human sacrifice and murder and disappearances that exists in Malta that is often attributed to worship of the serpent. That might be too far of a reach for some people, and maybe it is, but it is a very strange case that is still unsolved in Malta. An interesting connection is to the god known as Baal, and if you are a Christian listener, you've probably heard of Baal before. He's a famous character in Canaanite mythology, and he has an association with serpents, of course, and serpent iconography was common in religious artifacts relating to him. That's why I'm so surprised when I say that I saw the image of a golden bull at the Olympics. Basically, exactly how it was described in the Bible when God's chosen people opted for Baal the bull instead of him. I don't know if anybody else saw that, but that giant golden bull on stage at the Olympics was probably, in my opinion, seemed to be symbolism for Baal. What an interesting correlation, right? Part of what makes it interesting is how ancient it is, how long we've been on this topic of Baal and ancient serpent gods. You know, this kind of shows how it transcends time. I mean, look at all the worship of gods there were in the ancient, or mentioned in the Olympics. It was wild. Why are we still talking about that if none of it's real, if all of it's fake? The Nephilim and the Anunnaki are two distinct entities from different mythologies, okay? But they have become interwoven in modern conspiracy theories, particularly those involving some of these ancient civilizations, serpent worship, and extraterrestrial beings. So I want to sort of take a look at some of these figures and how they could fit into the narrative of reptilian worship and ancient deities, because it's important. And a lot of you guys have heard me talk about the Nephilim and Anunnaki before. The Nephilim are mentioned in the Bible, specifically in the book of Genesis, where they are described as the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men. These beings were considered giants or mighty men of renown. And some interpretations suggest that they were the result of unions between divine beings, often interpreted as fallen angels, and human women. That's essentially what they were. In some conspiracy theories, the Nephilim are reimagined, however, as reptilian or hybrid beings with both human and non-human traits. And this could explain where a lot of creatures like Bigfoot or Dogman come from. This ties into the broader narrative of ancient, possibly extraterrestrial beings who interacted with humanity in its early stages. The idea that the Nephilim were giants with extraordinary powers has led some to link them to the concept of a reptilian elite, beings who might have been worshipped as gods or feared as demonic entities. Connections to ancient cults also exist in this idea, the theory that ancient serpent cults might have venerated the Nephilim as divine or semi-divine figures is prominent. If these beings were seen as powerful otherworldly entities, it's absolutely conceivable that they would be worshipped, feared, or both by early humans. And of course, conspiracy theories often suggest that remnants of these ancient practices can be found in modern secret societies or religious practices. I say conspiracy theorists suggest it, but the fact of the matter is it's true. You can just look at that kind of stuff that's going on in the Vatican or in any religion in the world, but I specifically mention Catholicism so that people know that it's not special. It has also been infiltrated by this serpent cult. The Anunnaki, on the other hand, were extraterrestrial beings from the planet Nibiru. That's where they're believed to be from. And they arrived on Earth around some 450,000 years ago, and they found early hominins such as Homo erectus, basically, and genetically modified them to create modern humans, us, Homo sapiens, to serve as a sort of labor force. This genetic engineering supposedly endowed humans with advanced cognitive abilities, which enabled them to develop things like language, art, and the complex societies that we have today. The theory, of course, says that the Anunnaki used their advanced technology, since they were extraterrestrials, to splice their own DNA with that of these earlier, more ape-like humans. And then they created a hybrid species, us, capable of carrying out tasks like mining for gold, which the Anunnaki, of course, needed to repair their planet's atmosphere. It's pretty sci-fi, but it does blend in nicely with the theory of fallen angels if you look at it from that light instead. The Anunnaki are credited with teaching humans the fundamentals of agriculture, which allowed for the establishment of stable communities. And this led to their development of cities such as Eridu, Ur, and Uruk in ancient Sumer, which were real places where the Anunnaki were actually worshipped as gods in the ancient times. That's how far back this goes. This isn't some like new idea. This is something that we actually have written accounts of, these beings, these ancient Anunnaki being worshipped in these cities. They're also said to have provided humans with knowledge about irrigation, crop cultivation, and animal domestication. And that, of course, laid the groundwork for some of this prominent agricultural work that we're seeing in the ancient times, this revolution. This knowledge was critical, of course, in transforming human society from small nomadic groups into more large and complex civilizations capable of supporting huge populations. The invention of cuneiform writing, which is one of the earliest known writing systems, is also attributed to the Anunnaki. This system allowed humans to record their history, laws, and religious practices, and there's a massive amount of time where we don't have this writing. So, and that's one reason that this cuneiform is so fascinating, I guess you could say. Because according to our ideas, according to secular ideas, there's no way that this writing could have existed when it did. But the system, you know, it allowed these early humans to tell us a lot about their religious practices and laws. And this is all knowledge that these ancient people said was passed down to them by the Anunnaki. And writing, of course, enabled the codification of laws, such as the Code of Hammurabi, the recording of astronomical observations, and the documentation, of course, of medical practices, all of which contributed to the advancement of human civilization and helps is a foundation for where we are today. The Anunnaki are believed to have shared advanced knowledge in many fields: astronomy, mathematics, medicine, metallurgy. They are said to probably have introduced humans to the concept of a 360-degree circle, maybe even a 60-minute hour, and the 12-month calendar, all of which are still in use today. Their knowledge of astronomy, particularly in the movements of the planets and stars, allowed ancient civilizations to develop very accurate calendars and navigate massive distances. This knowledge, of course, was crucial for every aspect of their survival: agriculture, navigation, and, of course, the timing of their religious festivals, which they believed needed to be carried out to appease the gods who gave them all this knowledge. The Anunnaki are also said to have established religious and social structures according to these ancient records. They were worshipped as gods and god kings, and their laws and decrees became the foundation of early legal systems. Just imagine that. Temples dedicated to the Anunnaki, such as the ziggurats of ancient Mesopotamia, served as both religious and administrative centers, and they reinforced the Anunnaki's role as both spiritual and temporal leaders. This divine kingship model was emulated by humans. It's why it is the way it is today, who claimed descent from or favor with the Anunnaki to basically legitimize their power. And, you know, if you look at the established families that continue to remain in power, you'll see that there are sort of reflections of that in modern governments as well. It does seem that everybody who becomes powerful is somehow, especially in the United States, is somehow connected to some kind of royal family or another, some kind of ancient hero's family. It's interesting. The artistic and cultural achievements of ancient civilizations, including their architecture, literature, and religious practices, are said to have been influenced by the Anunnaki as well. And the monumental architecture of the time, like the pyramids and the ziggurats, is of course attributed to the guidance, inspiration, maybe even the literal help, like physical labor-type help, of the Anunnaki and Nephilim. The Epic of Gilgamesh, one of the oldest known pieces of literature, features gods and demigods that many theorists believe are based on these Anunnaki. So how do they fit together, right? Well, how do we connect this to Malta is what I really mean. The Nephilim and the Anunnaki are often central to ancient alien theories, which suggest that early human civilizations were either guided by or created by extraterrestrial beings. And I think we all, if we're here, sort of believe that kind of in a weird way. Either it's aliens who are kind of guiding us, we are aliens, or there's something spiritual going on. The connection to serpent worship comes from the idea that these beings were either reptilian in some way or associated with serpentine symbolism, leading to their deification by early humans. Something made them appear reptilian to early humans. The blending of these figures into a single narrative reflects a modern sort of synchronism of ancient myths and religious beliefs. By combining elements from the Bible and Sumerian mythology and conspiracy theory a narrative is formed that ties together these various strands, these stories of ancient history, into one single cohesive story of extraterrestrial or angelic influence on humanity. You know, the theory like further suggests that the ancient worship of serpent gods, which are possibly inspired by encounters with these Nephilim or Anunnaki, has left a lasting legacy in human cultures. And this legacy can be seen in the continued presence of serpent symbolism, even today. Secretive cults, the belief in hidden reptilian rulers who manipulate the world, these are stories we've heard before. Why? Many theories often suggest, too, that the Nephilim are giants. We've talked about that extensively, and I think probably most of us believe that they were giants. So it's no wonder that giant bones were also found in Malta. There's one very significant Anunnaki, and if you're wondering, sure, these beings may very well be Elohim as well. You know, there's a lot of different names for these things, and we don't really have it all truly figured out. So there's a lot of speculation, but yes, the Anunnaki could be the Elohim. Or they might be an actual alien race, something that another species that just exists out there. But that's something that I'm still researching. As I was saying, though, there's one very significant Anunnaki, and his name is Astarte. Or her name, I should say. Astarte is a powerful and influential goddess in ancient Middle East. She fits into the broader narrative of reptilian worship and conspiracy theories through her connections to fertility, war, and the earth. And though she's not directly associated with serpents or reptilian beings, her role in ancient religion and the widespread influence of her worship could have intertwined with serpent symbolism quite easily, and the veneration of deities like the Nephilim and the Anunnaki, right? In the context of conspiracy theories, Astarte could be seen as part of an ancient, hidden legacy of knowledge and power that continues to influence human history and beliefs today in the same exact place and way. I mean, look at the current conflict in Gaza, where ancient serpent god statues have been found. Look how this entire space has been at war since time began. Look at the worship of these types of gods in that area today. The idea that Astarte and other ancient deities, such as the Anunnaki, perhaps, were actually extraterrestrial beings is a concept that's kind of rooted in the broader ancient astronaut theory. And this theory is popularized by authors like Eric von Daniken and Zechariah Sitchin. I'm reading one of his books right now, actually, right here, The 12th Planet. That's pretty cool. You know, and they suggest that many of the gods worshipped by ancient civilizations were, in fact, aliens who visited Earth and significantly influenced the development of human societies. So Astarte is known in various cultures by different names. Ishtar in Mesopotamia, Ashtoreth in the Bible. She's a powerful goddess associated with fertility, war, and sexuality. And according to ancient astronaut theorists, she could have been an extraterrestrial being. We just, you know, that's their little theory. Yours and mine might be something different. Mine is probably that she's an Elohim, some kind of god that actually existed and was smited down or perhaps is crawling around on the ground somewhere to this day. If she was an alien, part of an alien race, or if fallen angels do have technology, sometimes we're reluctant to think that possibly these spiritual beings could have tech, but if they did, her advanced tech could have seemed like godlike to early humans, leading to her worship. Ashtoreth and Baal in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible, are frequently mentioned as deities worshipped by the neighboring peoples of the Promised Land, and at times by the Israelites themselves. The Bible often portrays their worship as a significant religious threat to the worship of Yahweh, our God, leading to numerous condemnations and efforts to eradicate these cults. You know, they're even mentioned in the Bible, guys. And if you bring it back to the Olympics a little bit and all of their symbols of fertility and Baal, it really makes this seem like more fact than fiction, as many would have us believe. So you want to know more about Baal and this bull symbol. The bull is a common symbol of fertility in many ancient cultures due to its virility and strength. And Baal, as a god who controlled the weather and brought rain, was closely associated with agricultural fertility. The bull symbol emphasized Baal's role as a life giver who ensured the production of land. In ancient art and religious iconography, Baal is often depicted with bull horns or in the company of bulls. Some images show Baal standing on a bull or holding a lightning bolt, further reinforcing his connection to both the bull's strength and his power over the storms. And the worship of Baal sometimes involved rituals that included bull sacrifices, and these sacrifices were meant to appease the god and to ensure his favor in granting rain and fertility to their land. His symbolism in these rituals is highlighting the connection between Baal and the forces of life and nature. Baal is often referred to as Baal Hadad, the storm god, and is also depicted as the champion of the gods who defeats chaos monsters like Yam, the sea god. The bull represents both Earth's fertility and the god's pure, raw power. He is a fitting symbol for a warrior deity. And Astarte and Baal were deeply interconnected deities within the ancient Near Eastern religious framework. They symbolized powerful and complementary forces of nature. Their worship, the myths surrounding them, their roles as consorts, they all sort of highlight the integrated nature of ancient religious practices, where deities were not isolated entities, but part of this universal, complex web the whole world over of divine relationships and influences with something more powerful than ourselves, essentially. Their shared cultural context, the roles in mythology, the frequent pairing and rituals, they underscore, in my opinion, the importance of the religious life of the Canaanites and the Phoenicians. Going back to Zechariah Sitchin a little bit, particularly in The 12th Planet, which is the book that I'm reading now, he suggests that the Anunnaki were extraterrestrials, kind of like we already said, from this planet Nibiru, which he claimed has an elongated orbit that brings it near to Earth like every 3,600 years. And according to Sitchin, the Anunnaki came to Earth to mine gold, like we said, which they needed because that, I guess, is what their planet's atmosphere is made of or something, and they need our gold. So they genetically engineer humans to serve as their workforce. In this context, deities like Astarte, who were worshipped in the ancient Near East, could have been among these alien beings, right? These ancient astronaut theorists argue that the myths and legends surrounding deities like Astarte and the Anunnaki are not just symbolic or religious, but are based on real historical events involving extraterrestrial beings. And these gods are thought to have left behind this knowledge and influence that shaped our human civilization. And their worship is seen as the earliest form of contact between humans and aliens. So, you know, like, I know we're kind of beating a dead horse here, but the fact of the matter is you got to look at it one way, right? Either none of this exists, or, you know, the ancient astronaut theorists do have some pull here. I don't know. What do you guys think? But some proponents of this theory, of course, believe that the influence of these extraterrestrial beings continues to this day, and that's why we still see bizarre things happening in Malta and the Black Desert and the Middle East and Ukraine, all this weird sort of stuff going on. It's pulled by this ancient serpent-worshipping collection of deities and followers. And through secret knowledge passed down through mystery schools or through even direct influence, the hidden elites can control everything. And for this reason, it wouldn't surprise anybody to learn that Hitler also had an extreme interest in Malta. While Malta was strategically important during World War II due to its location in the Mediterranean, some conspiracy theorists suggest that Hitler's interest in the island was going well beyond the military strategy, and he had a much more mystical motivation to go there. And a lot of us know that Hitler was incredibly deeply in bed with occult practices and looking for lost relics, ancient mysteries. That was very much, he had an entire department of his government dedicated to that kind of stuff. So Malta is home to some of the oldest known megalithic temples in the world, such as the Hagar Kim, the Menadra, and of course the Halsafleni Hypogeum. These sites have long been shrouded in mystery, and theories suggest that they were centers of ancient wisdom, energy, or maybe even portals to other dimensions. So Hitler, who was fascinated by ancient civilizations and their lost knowledge, of course probably believed that Malta held esoteric secrets that could be harnessed and used by the Nazi cause. Then we have this mysterious group known as the Knights of Malta, also known as the Knights Hospitaller, or the Knights Hospitaller, however you guys say it. I'm going to call them the Knights of Malta for now. And they have a long and storied history that includes numerous legends and conspiracy theories. And some believe that the Knights possess secret knowledge or treasure related to the Templars. And of course they did. We will get to that eventually. I don't know if it's going to be in this episode. It might be in the next one. But the Templars are another group surrounded by these esoteric theories, as I'm sure many of you know. The connection between the Knights of Malta and these ancient secrets probably attracted Hitler, who is believed to have sought out these powerful relics and this occult knowledge. The Annenerbe was an organization within the SS, Hitler's elite group, and it was tasked with researching these ancestral heritages, these examples of ancestral heritage of the Aryan race, and exploring ancient esoteric knowledge. This group conducted expeditions all around the world in search of artifacts, sacred sites, and mystical knowledge that they actually believed could grant the Nazis supernatural power or influence over global events. This is one of the most powerful military forces in man's history, and one of the biggest showcases of psychological manipulation that perhaps has ever been witnessed. And he's believing in this kind of stuff. He's looking for this kind of stuff. His symbolism reflects these old gods. What's going on? You know, Malta, with its history and mysterious sites, was probably very valuable in his quest. You know, some people say that Hitler was searching for the Holy Grail, the Spear of Destiny, powerful things believed to bestow invincibility and divine favor. Malta, with its ties to the Knights Templar, the Knights of Malta, the ancient serpent cults, and, you know, all of this ancient religious significance, it might have been considered a potential hiding place for such relics. The Nazi belief in the occult, combined with their interest in controlling sacred and powerful locations, could easily explain why Malta was highly sought after. But of course, another theory says that Hitler's interest in Malta was linked to its position on ley lines, or its status as a power center. And according to these traditions, ley lines are energy paths that crisscross the earth, connecting sacred sites and natural power points, and they actually exist. It's not a conspiracy theory, it's real. Malta's ancient temples and underground complexes could have been set up as, you know, areas to tap into these energy lines. And that would also make the island a strategic location, not just militarily, but also spiritually. So Hitler's conquest of Malta could have been seen as a very symbolic victory, representing the Nazi domination of both the material and spiritual worlds. And by conquering a place of such historical and esoteric importance, Hitler might have believed that he could actually further assert Nazi dominance over Europe, not just strategically, but metaphysically as well. Now, the Knights of Malta still exist today, and they're now called the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. And there's a lot of secrets and conspiracies involving them, but they're essentially a sovereign entity not subject to the same laws as those around them, kind of like the Vatican. And they're often the subject of modern conspiracy theories that link them to secret societies like the Freemasons or the Illuminati. And those theories are very valid. They suggest that the Knights continue to wield significant power behind the scenes, influencing global events through a network of influential members. And if they control Malta, being the Knights of Malta, they may have control over this powerful location. If Hitler believed that the Knights held ancient secrets or maintained control over powerful esoteric knowledge, he might have sought to capture Malta to tap into that power. But interestingly, despite Nazi interest, Malta was never able to fall into Hitler's control. Hitler lost a ton of planes trying to take it and was unsuccessful. It became too expensive, and some attribute him failing to take Malta as one of the greatest mistakes of his time in power. And if he had not done this, if he had not tried to take Malta, then he may have won the war. That's how many resources that Hitler dedicated to trying to take Malta, just to not capture it in the end. The fact that Malta never fell into his control, the island is very proud of that. They became a symbol of defiance against tyranny because of that. And the history of the Knights of Malta defending the island as well, I mean, this island has been a place of contest for many, many years. And there are many insane battle stories from here. So these deep ties to the Knights of Malta, who, very suspicious. The Knights of Malta, now known as the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, are obviously a Catholic religious order with a history dating back to the 11th century. And the order has long been shrouded in mystery and is subject to numerous conspiracy theories. These theories often center on the Knights' alleged involvement in global power structures, secret societies, and their control over hidden knowledge or wealth. The Knights of Malta originated as the Knights Hospitaller, a military order founded during the Crusades to provide care for sick and injured pilgrims in the Holy Land, and they were brutal as well. Over time, they became a powerful military and political force, defending Christian territories and amassing significant wealth and land holdings. Some people believe that they are still, in the end, going to be the perpetrators of this global bank system. The Order's long history, secretive nature, and independence from any single national government have led many to assume that they must hold true influence, and the Knights of Malta, being a sovereign entity with diplomatic relations with over 100 cultures or countries, they have their own passports and a unique status. This is not your normal group or little cult. This is something much more powerful. This has fueled theories that the Order operates as a powerful behind-the-scenes player in global affairs with a hidden agenda. And it seems to be a group that many powerful people are able to somehow join in one way or another, especially presidents and powerful people who are connected to ancient families. One of the most persistent conspiracy theories, of course, about the Knights of Malta is their alleged connection to other secret societies, especially like the Freemasons and the Illuminati. And some theories suggest that the Knights are part of a broader network of elite organizations that work together to influence global events. And this network is often depicted as controlling governments, economies, and even wars to achieve what many say in hushed tones doesn't exist, the New World Order. And another related theory ties the Knights of Malta to the Knights Templar, another medieval military order that has become, of course, the subject of many legends and conspiracies, and also still kind of exists to this day, by the way. And some believe that when the Templars were disbanded, which they weren't. They were murdered in the 14th century. Their wealth, secrets, and members were absorbed by the Knights of Malta, who continued the Templars' mission in secret. But of course, the Knights of Malta have a very close relationship with the Vatican and the Catholic Church. It would be kind of bizarre for this group to just murder them for no reason without being told. It leads to theories that they exert significant influence over the Church, the Knights of Malta do. Some conspiracists suggest that the Order is involved in efforts to steer the Church itself, particularly in ways that align with broader geopolitical agendas. During the Cold War, several high-ranking members of the Knights of Malta were linked to intelligence agencies like the CIA, and CIA directors William Donovan and William Casey were both members of the Order. This is what I mean by powerful people, somehow all connected to this ancient order originating in Malta. And this has led to speculation that the Knights were involved in many covert operations during the Cold War, acting as intermediaries or maybe even puppet masters in global espionage and political maneuvering. The Knights of Malta are believed by some to control vast hidden wealth. Of course, we've all heard the legend of the Templar treasure. The Knights of Malta have accumulated wealth over centuries from their landholdings, the donations, and, you know, of course, the inheritance of the Templars' treasures, if you can call it an inheritance. It's really a theft. This wealth is thought to be used to finance secretive operations or to maintain the Order's influence over world events. The Knights are also linked to the search for powerful religious relics, such as the Holy Grail, or of course, the Ark of the Covenant. And this theory that these relics still exist suggests that if they're found and controlled by the Knights would have immense power, both spiritual, supernatural, and probably physically. Some conspiracy theories say that the Knights of Malta continue to play a role in contemporary global events. And that is largely what the ongoing conflict in the Middle East is all thanks to. You know, with their extensive network of influential figures in politics, business, military, why wouldn't they play these games if they're capable to prop themselves up higher, to give more power to these false gods? And the ancient connections of the Knights Hospitaller or the Knights of Malta, they're just as suspicious and creepy as the modern connections. William Cooper, in his book, Behold a Pale Horse, discussed the concept of the Brotherhood of the Snake and made connections between the ancient secret society and the Knights Templar. Cooper suggested that these groups were part of a continuous line of secret societies that have wielded power and hidden knowledge throughout history. And according to Cooper, the Brotherhood of the Snake, which is an ancient order that allegedly was founded by the Sumerian god Enki, who was probably an Anunnaki, is one of the earliest secret societies, and its teachings and influence were carried forward through various organizations, including the Knights Templar, and therefore the Knights of Malta. But it gets a little bit creepier. Cooper described the Brotherhood of the Snake as an ancient organization that was established to enlighten humanity with knowledge, but later became corrupt and was basically used to control and manipulate people. Cooper believed that the Knights Templar were part of this lineage of secret societies that inherited this esoteric knowledge and power from the Brotherhood of the Snake. He argued that the Templars, who were originally founded as a Christian military order during the Crusades, became involved in occult practices in these faraway lands and gained access to some kind of secret knowledge that had been passed down through the ages. He further suggested that after the suppression of the Knights Templar in the 14th century, their knowledge and influence didn't simply disappear like many people think, but they were instead absorbed by these other secret societies that assisted in their disappearance, their murder. And some of these other secret societies have been called Freemasons, the Illuminati. He believed that these groups continue to work in the same fashion of the Brotherhood of the Snake, because they are the Brotherhood of the Snake. And they shape these global events and control world affairs from behind the scenes. You know, Cooper has some amazing theories. Some are really out there, and some seem to hit home in a pretty big way. The Brotherhood of the Snake and the Knights Templar being connected is part of this continuous tradition of secret societies, and it's existed since ancient times. This isn't a conspiracy theory. This is, we have evidence of them. These groups are believed to have preserved and transmitted esoteric knowledge, and they continue to use it and to wield power and influence over all of us, over humanity. That's why it's strange to many people to find out that the Knights of Malta could possibly be the Knights Templar. They were both founded during the Crusades. The Templars were around 1119, and they were incredibly wealthy and influential, and they were known for their role in protecting Christian pilgrims and pioneering the banking system. Hospitallers, founded early in the 11th century, initially focused on providing care for the sick and wounded, but later took on military functions similar to the Templars. And despite their shared origins and missions, the two orders were sometimes rivals, and particularly they competed for resources, influence, and of course the favor of the European monarchs and the Pope. And the story goes that in 1307, King Philip IV of France was heavily in debt to the Templars, and he ordered the arrest of many of the Templar Knights and accused them of heresy, blasphemy, and many other crimes, and this led to the eventual dissolution of the order. The sudden dramatic fall of the Templars, which was one of the most powerful organizations in medieval Europe, led to, of course, many rumors and conspiracy theories about who might have been involved and who stood to benefit. The theory, of course, suggests that it was the Hospitallers, the rivals of the Templars. It makes sense, and they had a strong motive to see the Templars dismantled. So with the Templars gone, they could potentially take their wealth, their lands, their influence. And versions of this theory argue that they colluded with King Philip IV and Pope Clement V, providing information and support to facilitate the Templars' downfall, their murder. Now, the transfer of some Templar assets to the Hospitallers after the dissolution of the Templars is cited as just circumstantial evidence that they did benefit from the Templars' demise. But another theory suggests that the Hospitallers played a role in the legal and inquisitorial process that led to the Templars' destruction as well, which basically means they were the judge, the jury, and the executioner. And while there is no direct historical evidence of such involvement, it's not hard to imagine that that's what was going on, especially with the Hospitallers' deep connection to the church and the European nobility. Basically, what we have here is the Templars took the ancient narrative, the ancient histories, the magical stuff we're not supposed to know about, the knowledge of all of that and the treasures involved from the Brotherhood of the Snake. Through occult means, they became the Brotherhood of the Snake. And then that continued to the Knights of Malta, who massacred the Templars and took all that knowledge, took all that esoteric and occult knowledge and treasure and information, these ancient texts that they may, who knows what they have. And they continue to hold it to this day, continuing the line, continuing the work of the Brotherhood of the Snake. Malta continues to be a station of mystery. And we're going to talk a lot more about that mystery and why they were known as the Brotherhood of the Snake and what this reptilian ancestry really means. And we're going to talk about the sacred geography of the Middle East and the biblical prophecies. We're going to talk about geopolitical manipulation, and we're going to talk about this ancient cult, what they look like, what they sound like, where they're from, what they actually worship, and why they're set up so deeply entrenched in these areas with ley lines, and what their symbolism is. We're going to go into all of that. So I know this is getting a little long, and I know that you guys are probably getting kind of tired of this topic, but I've got to see it through to the end. So there's going to be a part 3. Thank you guys for tuning in. I hope this continues to interest you for one more episode. If not, you could just tell me that you're done with it and I will stop doing it. But so far, it seemed like the feedback was good from you guys with episode one of this little mini series. So here's part two, and part three will be next week. So thanks for tuning in, guys. Remember to go to 21cdstudios.com to find my links and to give me a follow. I will see you guys next time. Remember, don't drink the water, question everything.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.